This could be a very short message. We'll see how it goes. It's weird after barely got through last week, and right after the gathering ended, my voice just shut down. Nothing but air for 3 days. I was beginning to wonder if it was ever going to come back. And have you tried to have a phone conversation when you can only whisper? I mean, it's really weird because right off you feel like a pervert. You know, like you're just some kind of obscene call and you're trying to get anything out, you know. It's just the strangest feeling. But this was one of those weeks, maybe because I was so isolated for the first part of the week, I didn't have as many conversations because I couldn't, that I really had not much of a clue what I wanted to talk about today until really just yesterday. And I wanted to tell you what happened yesterday afternoon with my son. I had to do some errands, you know, just plain old boring errands. Need to go to the bank, basically, was what it was. And so I decided to ask Brennan if he wanted to come with me. Brennan is our 7-year-old. And usually it's about 50-50 if he ever wants to go with me, because he's still pretty much a mama's boy right now. I don't blame him. If I was Marion's son, I'd probably be a mama's boy, too. She's a good mom. So most of the time he wants to stay with mom, but this time he actually said, okay, I'll go. So we had to go through the whole ritual, you know, suddenly for just a quick errand, it's now a production, because you got to find his pants and you got to find his shoes and his socks. And then of course he's got to have SpongeBob and Squidward and Patrick and this and that he takes with him. And then we had to find the little, energy bar that mom had gotten for him that he likes really well. So we got all this stuff now. We climb into the car, and he loves riding in the big van with me because he can sit in the front, no airbags, you know. So he's in the front. We're riding. And we head out into the day, and it was a day right after the rains. So between being a fall day and being a day right after the rains, it was like one of the most perfect days. If you remember yesterday, all day long, there was just these crystal blue skies with these clouds. And they weren't cumulus clouds this time. They were the kind of clouds that looked like they were ripped right off the cotton candy stick, you know, and with those real soft edges and moving and floating and creating this patchwork of shadow and light, you know, all over the place. And we got to the bank and we did our thing there, and his sister was working there, so he went up to her teller window and had a conversation while I went to my teller window and did business, and then afterwards decided to go have some bagels. Because bagels are about his most favorite thing to eat on the planet. And so we went to the bagel place and got our bagels and decided to go sit out in this little courtyard near a fountain and eat our bagels. And as I was sitting there, and I'm just watching him, watching that little face, and all the things that come tumbling out of his mouth, everything from, you know, he's talking about his latest video game to SpongeBob to something he learned at school. It's just totally random access. You know, all the stuff is coming out, and he's munching on his bagels, and he tells me he's got a loose tooth right in front, and he had trouble eating and chewing the bagel, so he asked me if I'd tear them into our bagel bites. That's what we used to do when he was really small, you know, pull them into small pieces, and he's eating. And at one point, I just kind of sat back in my chair, and I put my head against the backrest and just was staring at the sky and watching these impossible clouds just do this dance up there. You know, it just takes the clouds make the sky look 3D. I don't know if you ever thought about that. There's this all of a sudden this depth to them, and I'm watching, and then they'd go in front of the sun, and they'd be lit from within. And I flashed back to when I was a kid, and we used to just lay on the grass, remember, and just watch the clouds for like hours on end. When did we ever have that much time in our lives to lay in the grass and watch the clouds? And here I was doing it with my little 7-year-old. And as I was listening to him, and I realized, I remember that time when everything was so important, no matter how minuscule that it was, and how I wanted to run and tell my parents everything, and they would be bored, or they wouldn't even want to hear it, or they'd be dismissing me. But it was important to me. And I realized that all these things are just as important to him. And this was one of those moments, you know. And he kept coming up with all sorts of things. What if there were fish in the pond? What would happen then? And, you know, what do the birds eat? And where do they go at night? And just all this stuff. It was just one of those moments. And yet, I'm describing it to you in all this detail. But if I were doing a kind of an executive summary of my life, where would this incident place in the hierarchy of things that are important? I mean, if I was to tell you, oh, what did you do today, dear? Oh, I went to the bank and got bagels. Well, that's nothing much to write home about. But it totally misses the point of the moment. That was one of those moments that I have a really clear memory of that I'll take with me to my grave. And when that tooth comes out, and I'll mourn the passage of that, and the big tooth comes in, and I'll mourn that as well. And who knows where he's going to go from here. I had a friend who was talking to me, and she said, you know, if we all really knew what raising a child was totally going to be like, do you think we'd have any? You know, she's got teenagers right now and really going through it. And I don't know. I'll tell you right now, at age 7, it's so worth it. And he just brings this light to our lives. And yet, yeah, there could be all sorts of tears and trials as he grows and those permanent teeth come in. And I was thinking, you know, my son, as much as I love him, you know, he's not particularly remarkable, I guess. You know, there are kids half his age who are doing concerts at Carnegie Hall, for crying out loud. And he loves his Legos, but he's not like making the Taj Mahal out of them or anything. But that misses the point too, doesn't it? And we got home, and that connection being established, I went back to work, of course, because I needed to. And he kept coming up to me, you know, at intervals and wanting to show me the next thing he made out of Legos. And it was like, do you like my Squidward house? You know, I'm getting good at Legos, aren't I? You know, and all those little attempts at connection and affirmation that we all need and we all want. But when you're 7 years old, it just piles right out. And I realized that through all of this, there was this constant struggle within me to stay in that moment, to not lose connection with the moment. Because even as we were sitting there by the fountain, my mind would go back to all the work that still needed to be done and all the things that were left undone and needed to be done. And it was calling me out of the moment and saying, okay, we need to cut this short. I need to get back to the things that are important, you know? And as soon as I realized that I was in that space in my head, I'd stop and I'd just watch my son again, or I'd watch the clouds. Because there was no reason to cut this moment short except for that tick in my head that kept pulling me out, pulling me out, pulling me out. And then back at home, working again, doing those important things, and my son coming up, and the temptation to just say, well, not now, Brennan, you know, I got to work, rather than just to turn to him and give him the 35 seconds that he needed just to feel connected and to run off again and do the next thing that he does. It's a total struggle for me. I know it's a total struggle for all of us. We constantly measure. We look at our moments and we're judging and measuring and trying to say, you know, what is important and what is not. By our own standards of judgments, which one of us is remarkable? Which one of us is doing the concerts at Carnegie Hall or rising to the pinnacle of our chosen professions? And we compare and we contrast. And usually we end up on the losing end of the stick and we feel worse about ourselves. And we look at all the things that are left undone. And we look at all the people that are more accomplished than us. And we're constantly trying to see where we fit in and justify and strive and work hard and measure all of these things in some sort of level of priority and importance. We spend our lifetimes measuring great and small, don't we? Comparing and judging. But how great is great enough? And how small is too small? And what is really important in life anyway? How do we figure that out? I wanted to read you something. And we didn't quite get the bulletins out today, but at least we were able to get to you, for some of you, some of what I wanted you to have in front of you. What I want to read you is from a Chinese philosopher called Chuang Tzu, who lived in the 4th through the 3rd centuries BCE. And before you start writing letters to the Chancery office, so there goes Dave again, you know, reading from those Chinese people instead of from the Bible. I do this not because I want you all to become Taoists. I do this because he has a way of articulating the exact same message that Jesus is articulating, but in a way that can recapture our imaginations. When things become so familiar, so covered over with what we think we know, sometimes it's another point of view that can cut through all of that and illuminate what Jesus is trying to tell us. But this phenomena in our lives of measuring great and small and always looking to see where we stand in that pecking order is something that has plagued mankind from the very beginning. And this is exactly what Chang Tzu is dealing with when he writes this little piece called Autumn Floods. It was the time of the autumn floods. Every stream poured into the river, which swelled in its turbid course. The banks receded so far from one another that it was impossible to tell a cow from a horse. Don't you love little details like that that tell you that the person was there? What does it look like when the river is so wide now that you can't tell the difference between a cow and a horse on the other side? I love those kind of details. Brings it right to life. Then the spirit of the river laughed for joy that all the beauty of the earth was gathered to himself. Down with the stream he journeyed east until he reached the ocean. There, looking eastward and seeing no limit to its waves, his countenance changed. And as he gazed over the expanse, he sighed and said to the spirit of the ocean, "A vulgar proverb says that he who has heard but part of the truth thinks no one equal to himself, and such a one am I. But now that I have looked upon your inexhaustibility, alas for me, had I not reached your abode, I should have been forever a laughingstock to those of comprehensive enlightenment." To which the spirit of the ocean replied, "You cannot speak of ocean to a well frog, the creature of a narrower sphere. You cannot speak of ice to a summer insect, the creature of a season. And you cannot speak of Tao to a pedagogue. His scope is too restricted." And there's two words there that might be difficult. Tao in Chinese literally means the way. And the way it's used is exactly the way Jesus used his way, Urha in Aramaic, his way of living life, his way to the Father. And a pedagogue is a stuffy, boring, unimaginative teacher. So you can't speak of the way to someone without imagination. Their scope is too restricted. But now that you have emerged from your narrow sphere and have seen the great ocean, you know your own significance, and I can speak to you of great principles. Don't you love that? Now that you know your own significance, now I can speak to you of great principles. But not before. What did Jesus say? You want to find your life? Lose it. And those who lose their lives for my sake, my way, my urha, my way to the Father, will find it. Same idea. Until we realize our insignificance, until we have met our limitations and accepted them in our lives. Step one for all you recovery people. There is no possibility of anything further. You cannot understand great principles until you realize your limitations. There is no body of water beneath the canopy of heaven which is greater than ocean. All streams pour into it without cease, yet it does not overflow. It is constantly being drained off, yet it is never empty. Spring and autumn bring no change. Floods and droughts are equally unknown. And thus it is immeasurably superior to mere rivers and brooks. Though I would not venture to boast on this account, for I get my shape from the universe, my vital power. In the universe I am but as a small stone or a small tree on a vast mountain. And conscious thus of my own insignificance, what is there of which I can boast? The four seas, are they not to the universe but like puddles in a marsh? The middle kingdom, is it not to the surrounding ocean like a tare seed in a granary? Of all the myriad created things, man is but one. And of all those who inhabit the land, live on the fruit of the earth, and move about in cart and boat, an individual man is but one. Is not he, as compared with all creation, but as the tip of a hair on a horse's skin? Very well, replied the spirit of the river. Am I then to regard the universe as great and the tip of the hair as small? And now you can follow in if you've got a sheet in front of you. Not at all, said the spirit of the ocean. Dimensions are limitless. Time is endless. Conditions are not invariable. And terms are not final. Thus, the wise man looks into space and does not regard the small as too little, nor the great as too much, for he knows that there is no limit to dimension. He looks back into the past and does not grieve over what is far off, nor rejoice over what is near, for he knows that time is without end. He investigates fullness and decay and does not rejoice if he succeeds, nor lament if he fails, for he knows that conditions are not invariable. He who clearly apprehends the scheme of existence does not rejoice over life, nor repine at death, for he knows that terms are not final. Dimensions are limitless. Time is endless. Conditions are not invariable. Terms are not final. Wow. Think about that for a second. You see, we get stuck in this little sliver of what we can comprehend, and we think that that's all that there is. And we forget that there is this whole other aspect of life that remains unseen and unmeasured. Yet we stick here in this place that we think we know. It's like the electromagnetic spectrum. You know, we think that all there is what we can see with our eyes. Roy G. Biv, right? Colors of the rainbow, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. That's the spectrum of what we can see, those frequencies. And yet beyond violet, there's ultraviolet. Beyond ultraviolet, there are X-rays and gamma rays up into infinity at the high end of the scale. And below red, there is infrared. And below that, there are microwaves. And below that, there are radio waves down into infinite. On the other side of the scale, this tiny little sliver is what our eyes are sensitive to. And because of that, we think that that's all there is. But there is so much more that is possible. It's the same problem that we have with God's love when you think about it. Isn't it? There's this little sliver of love that we think we can see. Based on our experience in life, what we can give, what we have received, what we think we have received or given. And yet, just like that spectrum, there is so much more that can't be measured. And if something can't be measured, then it has no degree. Do you see? If it has no degree, then it always looks the same. Perfect love is like that. It always looks the same because it can't be measured and therefore has no degree. I think we talked about this a couple of times, that our universe is an odd place, and astrophysicists are seeing it more and more clearly as they learn more and their experiments can go a little bit further. And Stephen Hawking now believes that the universe is finite. Okay, it's not infinite, it's finite. But it also has no edge. So put that one into your noodle and bake it for a while. Finite but has no edge. In other words, if you kept going in one direction long enough, you would never get to the end of it, past the end, and be able to look at the ball of the universe. It would never happen. Wherever you go, as far as you go, you would end up eventually back where you started. And every place and any place along that journey would look exactly the same as any other spot on the journey. The star field would always look equally dense in any direction that you looked, no matter how far you went in any direction. It can't be measured, so it has no degree. If it has no degree, it always looks the same. And what's the beauty of that? Wherever you are in the universe, mathematically, is exactly the center of the universe. And when you move and go someplace else, you're always at the center. And at the center, and at the center. Because it can't be measured, and it has no degree. God's love is the same way. It can't be measured, it has no degree, it always looks the same, and you're always right in the center of it. But as long as we look at only our narrow slice, we miss all of the significance of these type of ideas. That until we reach our own limitations, our own seeming insignificance, we can't see the great principles that lie beyond the things that we can measure. Life is like this too. One of my favorite talk radio hosts, who was an evening talk radio host, his name was Mr. KABC. And he never gave his name. I have no idea what his name was. He was just Mr. KABC. But every time a caller called up and asked him how he was doing. He had the same response. It was classic. Better in most, not as good as some. How you doing, Mr. KBC? Better in most, not as good as some. That's sort of who we are at any moment, all the time in our lives. We're better in most, not as good as some. No matter how good you get at anything that you strive to do, there's always someone better, and there are people who are worse. If we want to perceive these pecking orders in life, we can do it. Who's got the most money? Who's got the most talent? Who's got the most this? Who's got the most that? Happiness, spiritual integrity, you name it. We measure, we judge, we compare, we contrast. And as I said, usually end up on the losing end of that battle, of that stick. But if we could see the whole fabric of what God has laid out for us, there is no measurement, there is no degree, and everything looks the same. That's how God sees us. But it's not how we can see, with only this small sliver. To continue on with Chuang Tzu, he makes this point beautifully. He says, what a man knows is not to be compared with what he does not know. The span of his existence is not to be compared with the span of his non-existence. To strive to exhaust the great by means of the small necessarily lands him in confusion, and he does not attain his object. How then should one be able to say that the tip of the hair is the quintessence of smallness, or that the universe is the height of greatness? Philosophers of the day, replied the spirit of the river, all say that the infinitesimally small has no form, and the infinitesimally infinitely great is beyond all measurement. Is that so? If we regard greatness as compared with that which is small, said the spirit of the ocean, there is no limit to it. And if we regard smallness as compared with that which is great, it eludes our sight. The infinitesimal is a subdivision of the small, the colossal an extension of the great. In this sense, the two fall into different categories. This lies in the nature of circumstances. Now, smallness and greatness presuppose form. That which is without form cannot be divided by numbers, and that which is above measurement cannot be measured. The greatness of anything may be a topic of discussion, and the smallness of anything may be mentally imagined. But that which can be neither a topic of discussion nor imagined mentally can be said to be neither great nor small. And the next paragraph is on your sheets. Therefore, the truly great man does not injure others and does not credit himself with charity and mercy. Do you hear that? The truly great man does not injure others, but does not credit himself with charity and mercy. He seeks not gain, but does not despise the servants who do. He struggles not for wealth, but does not lay great value on his modesty. He asks for help from no man, but is not proud of his self-reliance. Neither does he despise the greedy. He acts differently from the vulgar crowd, but does not place high value on being different or eccentric. Nor because he acts with the majority does he despise those that flatter a few. The ranks and rewards of the world are to him no cause for joy, its punishments and shame no cause for disgrace. He knows that right and wrong cannot be distinguished, that great and small cannot be defined. I have heard say, the man of Tao has no reputation, or possibly that's no concern for reputation. Perfect virtue acquires nothing. Truly great men ignore themselves. This is the height of self-discipline. I know that's a lot of words, but here's what he's saying in a nutshell. The greatest virtue that we can imagine becomes non-virtue the moment that we begin to measure it. Do you see that? As soon as we measure it, as soon as it becomes a standard, it becomes non-virtue. The subtext behind what Chuang Tzu is writing is that Confucius, who came several centuries before him, had developed a system of ethical and moral behavior, and it became the standard throughout the entire kingdom, the multiple kingdoms of China at that time. And all of the courts and the officials and everyone in the land was trying to adhere to this virtuous system. So much so that it became simple adherence to a code of ethic. And they lost the virtue from which it sprang. Sound familiar? It should. It's the exact same battle that Jesus had with the Pharisees. The Pharisees started out trying to enumerate, to legislate, to codify their virtue. And in so doing, they created non-virtue because they created generations who were simply following rules for the sake of following rules and had lost the connection, the unity, the relationship that was supposed to stand at the heart of whatever we call virtue. Same fight that Chuang Tzu has with the Confucians of his day. Great virtue becomes non-virtue as soon as we measure it. Anything that we call good becomes bad as soon as we judge with it. Jesus says, don't judge, because the same system that you use to judge others will be judged for you, to you. You live under that yoke. No matter how good it is, once we use it to judge, it becomes its opposite. It's in the same way that nonconformity becomes conformity after a while. You ever notice that? I want to be different than you, and I just create my own measure of conformity. It's hilarious back in the 60s when the established culture was all buttoned down, white, skinny ties, you know, big black glasses, close-cropped hair. And here comes the counterculturalists, you know, the hippies with their long hair and beards and crazy jeans and tie-dye and drug culture, everything opposite from what they perceived as the establishment. But fast forward into when I was in high school in the 70s, and what had happened? That had become the norm. You weren't cool anymore if you didn't have your hair long. You weren't cool anymore if you didn't have the macrame hanging out of your pocket and all of the decals and patches on your jeans and all this stuff. It became the norm. So anything that we do, and each generation does it, trying to distinguish itself from the generation before, becomes its own conformist in its own new way. And the tragedy is that we don't even see that we're doing it. We don't realize what we've fallen into. The virtue that comes out from the deep places in our core, of our center of our being, that is established by Jesus, becomes just another system to bludgeon somebody else with if we're not careful. And it becomes its opposite. Again, because we only see with this sliver, we have these problems. And we do this measuring all our lives, don't we? This moment is more important than that moment. You know, this job, this vocation, this ministry, that takes precedence over that. How many moments do we really judge important in our lives anyway? As I've said before, most of us see most of our lives as flyover country. It's Nebraska, it's Kansas as we fly to the coasts, because the only meaningful thing is New York and LA, right? The rest we just fly over to get to those things. That's what we do with our lives. We judge these moments important, these goals important, these jobs important, and the rest is just the means to get there. It's just the dead time that we have to spend to get to something that's meaningful. When do we pay attention? What do we actually write home about? These are the things we need to ask ourselves, because it defines the quality of our lives. I want to read you another passage, this time from the Bible, so you can relax. From John 10, back in the Bible. Actually, John 11 first. And this is a story that I want to take from a completely different point of view. Now, a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So the sisters sent word to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. But when Jesus heard this, he said, this sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, what does he do? He stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to his disciples, let's go to Judea again. Okay. What in the world's going on here? Martha and Mary and Lazarus were siblings. They lived in Bethany, which was a mere 2 miles north of Jerusalem. Jesus, coming from Galilee in the far north, was always passing to Bethany and from Bethany as he was going back and forth to Judea. And so he had met them probably early in his career, and he got to know them. He would stay with them whenever he was in town. He loved them. They were his brothers and sisters. And when he hears that Lazarus is sick unto death, he stays 2 more days? What's going on there? It's interesting to me that the commentaries that I read on this chapter, every one of them said basically the same thing. Jesus delayed in order to give time for Lazarus to die, so that he could then perform the greater miracle. He had been healing all along. Never raised anyone from the dead yet. So he delayed 2 days longer to give the greater miracle. I don't know if that's true or not, but it sticks in my craw. Because would Jesus really do that? Would Jesus create pain, suffering, stress, anxiety in those whom he loved in order to have a greater moment than the moment he was already in? And what was this moment that he was in anyway? Let's step back. Always look for the wider context when you're trying to figure out a difficult passage. Right before this passage in John 11, the end of John 10, 39 to 42. Therefore, they were seeking again to seize him, and he eluded their grasp. For 3 chapters, 7, 8, 9, and 10, Jesus has been in Jerusalem, irritating the heck out of the authorities there, to the point that they have tried several times to grab him, to stone him, to incarcerate him, and he eludes their grasp. And once more he has done this. And he went away again beyond the Jordan to the place where John was first baptizing, and he was staying there. And many came to him and were saying, while John performed no sign, yet everything John said about this man was true. Many believed in him there. He is Transjordan. You've heard about the West Bank? This is the East Bank. This is what is now the present country of Jordan. It's the back of beyond. It's the other side of the tracks. It is the middle of nowhere. It's the sticks. Judea is downtown. Judea is where everything happens. Judea is the center of power. Jesus is way over there with a bunch of hicks on the other side of the Jordan. He gets a call from his friends that one of his closest friends is dying, and he stays there? Is it really just to give time for Lazarus to die? People were believing in him there. Were they less important than Lazarus? Were they less important than anybody else that Jesus had ever met? Were they less important than his closest followers? When something is so great that it can't be measured, it has no degree. And if it has no degree, it always looks the same. Through our sliver, we imagine certain things. But Jesus is practicing along the full spectrum of God's love, where everything looks the same. There is no degree. There is no great and small. That moment that he was spending in the sticks was just as important as any moment he had spent or would ever spend in his earthly life or in eternity for that matter. Every person is equally important. Every moment is equally sacred. If his presence, if our presence is there. He stayed until the fullness of what he was there for was accomplished, I believe. And then he went to his friend. But even there, what does Jesus know? What does Jesus know that we can't seem to grasp? Conditions are not invariable. Terms are not final. Oh, but he's been in the tomb 4 days, Lord. There'll be a stink. Don't open the door. Conditions are not invariable. Terms are not final. Not when you are looking at the full spectrum of possibility in the Father. This is who Jesus is. This is where he is taking his people. What we see and measure is simply not all there is. There is no job. There is no moment. There is no vocation. There is no child. that's more important than any other. The one we are with is the one that we should give our full attention to. And when we move and we are with another person, that's the person we give our full attention to. No moment is more important than this moment, right here, right now. These faces that I'm looking at right now, that you see the back of the heads of, these are the people that are most important right here, right now. There is no moment more important than this. There is no measure to these moments of our lives. Now, because I'm saying this to you, and I'm saying it with passion and fervor, I hope, you may think, well then, yeah, Dave's got this all figured out. Let me disabuse you of any such notion. Nothing could be further from the truth. When I'm having a peak moment with my 7-year-old under skies that to me are absolutely perfect, and I keep getting drawn off to other moments that my head is telling me are more important than this one, when I compare myself to other people who either do what I do, you know, or do things I wish I could do or did do, or make more money than me, and I wish that I could make that, and all of these thoughts that we all have, that we are all prey to, are the frailties of our human condition. But if we don't even know that they need to be resisted, that there is another place that we can go, how in the world will we ever get healthier than we are? Jesus is telling us that it's neither great nor small. That dimensions are limitless, that time is endless, that conditions are not invariable, the terms are not final, that there's a whole different way of looking at this life, and we can do it. I struggle with these things all the time. But I'll tell you what, my son, my 7-year-old, is trying to teach me. And I better learn fast, because he's only got a few more years himself to teach me. Right? Because there will come a time when the world draws him in, when he understands what we all understand, and he won't be able to teach anybody this lesson until he learns it again himself. So I've got this precious window with him where he can teach me how to see the world without degree, how to see life without greatness and smallness and comparisons and judgments, and all of the feelings of less than-ness that comes with that type and that way of looking at life. Every moment is sacred, as long as we are there and present to it. Every moment contains the seeds of completion, and there is neither great nor small. We are either present, and it is great and sacred, or we are not, and our life becomes small as a consequence. Jesus is bringing us the seeds of everything we need to make our life without degree, looking the same, without measurement, full of the life and love that God has for us. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for the truth that comes directly from you, through your word, through your son, and even through other traditions, Lord. Help us to be the kind of people that see truth and find truth where it is and not where we expect it to be. That we can learn to sense and see beyond the small sliver of life and love that we can easily measure to the vastness of what you have for us. We want to be a people that knows you better, Lord, that knows you to the degree that we begin to trust you and immerse ourselves in this limitless ocean. Take us out of our wells, out of the limits of what we think we know, and take us into the vastness of what you have to give us. Are so generous, Lord. We cannot comprehend your generosity and everything that you have for us. But thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's all stand.